A carriage door opens in Constantinople, November 1854.
A woman steps out, seasick but steady.
Before her sprawls the barrack hospital, miles of corridors packed with dying soldiers lying in their own filth.
Most people would flee. Florence Nightingale rolled up her sleeves.
Born into British wealth in 1820, Florence enjoyed everything privilege could offer: grand estates, European tours, the finest education.
Yet by age 6, she found this smooth, rich life distasteful.
At 17, something extraordinary happened. She heard a voice.
Not metaphorically, an actual voice speaking in human words, calling her to service. Like Joan of Arc, she experienced this divine summons 4 times throughout her life.
But what service?
That remained unclear for years.
What was clear? She could never be satisfied with embroidery in drawing rooms while the world suffered outside.
For 14 brutal years, Florence fought her first war, not against disease, but against her own family. 5 years to discover nursing was her calling, then 9 more battling her mother and sister to pursue it. In 1845, hospitals were chambers of horror. The hospital smell from accumulated filth made visitors vomit upon entering. Patients lay in beds less than 2 feet apart, often in sheets still soaked with the previous occupant's blood. Nurses were mostly unwed mothers and drunkards, sleeping in wooden cages on landing places. One physician trusted only 2 nurses in his entire hospital to administer medicine correctly. Florence's mother accused her of having a secret affair with some low, vulgar surgeon. Her sister had hysterics. Her father fled to London in disgust. But Florence had heard God's voice. She would not be moved.
When Britain's Crimean War wounded arrived at Scutari, they found hell. No beds, no kitchens, men dying on floors and blood-soaked blankets. The Times exposed it all, igniting national outrage. On October 18, 1854, Florence became superintendent of the female nursing establishment, the first woman ever appointed to such a position. She arrived with 38 nurses, hardly qualified, she noted. That stuff about the enthusiasm of nursing is all bosh. The doctors despised her, viewing female nurses as threats. They assigned her 6 flea-infested rooms and refused cooperation. Then November 9th changed everything. Casualties flooded in, and overwhelmed doctors had no choice but to accept her help. Florence didn't just nurse, she revolutionized. She established the hospital's first functioning kitchen, spent $30,000 of her own funds purchasing supplies in Constantinople's markets when official channels failed, and recruited journalists and politicians as her supply staff. Within weeks, everyone turned to her. The troops worshipped her. They stopped swearing in her presence, wrote home to their wives, kissed her shadow as it fell. One soldier wrote, "They would lay our heads on the pillow again content, just from seeing her pass."
Florence returned from Crimea, haunted by numbers. 73% mortality in 6 months, mostly from preventable disease. Worse, that same system was killing soldiers in peacetime British barracks. She compared mortality rates and discovered something shocking. In St. Pancras, civilians died at 2.2 per 1,000, lifeguards in barracks there at 10.4 per 1,000. In Kensington, civilians 3.3, soldiers at Knightsbridge Barracks 17.5. Her devastating conclusion: our soldiers enlist to death in the barracks. This wasn't nursing, it was statistical warfare. She compiled nearly 1,000 pages of data, charmed the lazy Secretary of State for War into establishing a royal commission, and worked through nights inspecting hospitals and writing by candlelight. Her family, basking in reflected glory, constantly interrupted while keeping the carriage for themselves. By August 1857, she collapsed, 4 weeks without solid food, living on tea. So ill, newspapers prepared her obituary. From her sickbed, she continued working,
insisting reform must not stop, even if she died.
Florence changed after her collapse. The fierce warrior softened. "I'm becoming quite a tame beast," she wrote in 1868. She began visiting family estates after 12 years of refusal, read Jane Austen, ranking her second to Shakespeare, and actually enjoyed her mother's company, finding her far dearer, far more respectable than ever before. When war erupted between Germany and France in 1870, everyone assumed she'd nurse again. She refused. She'd chosen organizational reform over romantic self-sacrifice. Her work on Indian sanitation affected millions and took precedence over European hospitals. Yet donations still poured in from poor congregations of all kinds, from Negroes in the West Indies, from ragged schools. Not from the wealthy, but from ordinary people who remembered Skousari. When her mother died in 1880, something remarkable happened. The 40-year conflict ended, not through death, but through reconciliation. Florence's old benevolence returned. She became gentle, even tolerant, reconciling with relatives she'd shut out for decades. For the first time since childhood, she grew intimate with her sister Parthy.
Few enjoyed such a radiant old age. Ministers, kings, and statesmen waited at her door. To millions of women worldwide, she symbolized new hope, proof that women could reshape society through intellect and determination. Though she never married, she became a beloved grandmother figure to a large circle. Her friends' children brought her their love affairs, examination papers, and daily crises. No detail was too small. A servant's character reference, the quality of meat, treating a cold. She wrote birthday letters to everyone from family to her butcher to policemen at the park gates. Slowly, the curtain descended. Blind, memory failing, she mistook visitors for friends from her youth. She asked for her brother-in-law, who'd been dead 12 years. When she'd passed beyond the world's power to please or pain, honors showered down. In 1907, King Edward VII gave her the Order of Merit, the first woman ever to receive it. When they brought the certificate to her bedside, she murmured, too kind, perhaps not understanding. She died peacefully on August 13, 1910, at 90 years old. She'd refused Westminster Abbey, requesting burial in the family grave, with only two lines on the tombstone: F.N., born 1820. Died 1910.
Florence Nightingale's legacy transcends reform. She proved rigorous data analysis could save more lives than compassion alone, and that women's intellect could reshape institutions that had defeated men for centuries. She transformed the British soldier from drunken brute to symbol of courage, and nurses from presumed drunkards to professionals embodying strength and selflessness. Her influence lives in every hospital sanitation standards, every nurse's training, every public health policy grounded in statistical evidence. She heard God's voice at 17 and spent 73 years answering through midnight work sessions, bureaucratic battles, and patient accumulation of undeniable facts. In a world that confined women to charm and home, she proved a woman armed with data, determination, and divine calling could save more lives than any general. Your move isn't to become Florence Nightingale. It's to ask what voice you've been ignoring, what calling you've deemed impossible, what world you could change if you stopped waiting for permission and started counting the cost of inaction.